ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 1, entitled The Manus Administrators of the Universe, Text 4 through 7. Text 4. Shri Rishir Uvacha Manavosmin Vyatitasai Kalpe Svayam Bhuvadaya Adyaste Kathito Yatra Devadinam Cha Sambhavaha. Translation. Shukadev Goswami said, in the present Kalpa, there have already been six Manus. I have described to you Swayambhuva Manu and the appearance of many demigods. In this Kalpa of Brahma, Swayambhuva is the first Manu. There's no purport, so we'll carry on. Swayambhuva Manu had two daughters named Akuti and Devahuti. From their wombs, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as two sons named Yajnamurti and Kapila, respectively. These sons were entrusted with preaching about religion and knowledge. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Devahuti's son was known as Kapila, and Akuti's son was known as Yajnamurti. Both of them taught about religion and philosophical knowledge. Text 6. Translation. O best of the Kurus, I have already described in the third canto the activities of Kapila, the son of Devahuti. Now I shall describe the activities of Yajnapati, the son of Akuti. Text 7. Translation. Swayambhuva Manu, the husband of Shatarupa, was by nature not at all attached to enjoyment of the senses. Thus he gave up his kingdom of sense enjoyment and entered the forest with his wife to practice austerities. Purport. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 4.2, Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo vidu. The supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and that saintly kings understood it in that way. All the Manus were perfect kings. They were Rajarishis. In other words, although they held posts as kings of the world, they were as good as great saints. Swayambhuva Manu, for example, was the emperor of the world, yet he had no desire for sense gratification. This is the meaning of monarchy. The king of the country or the emperor of the empire must be so trained that by nature he renounces sense gratification. It is not that because one becomes king, he should unnecessarily spend money for sense gratification. As soon as kings became degraded, spending money for sense gratification, they were lost. Similarly, at the present moment, monarchy having been lost, the people have created democracy, which is also failing. Now, by the laws of nature, the time is coming when dictatorship will put the citizens into more and more difficulty. If the king or dictator individually, or the members of the government collectively, cannot maintain the state or kingdom according to the rules of Manu Samhita, certainly their government will not endure. Herein, Srila Prabhupada, in the purport, is making some very broad visionary statements, which really give us a very direct understanding of how the world or the universe used to be governed, and which in turn really brought prosperity, peace, happiness to all. He says, all the Manus were perfect kings. They were Rajarishis. That means they were as good as great saints. So they functioned as the king, but in effect, they were first devotees, and then they happened to be discharging the duties of the king. And then Prabhupada clearly says, this is the meaning of monarchy. He's referring to the example of Swayambhuva Manu, who was the emperor of the world, yet he had no desire for sense gratification. And then Srila Prabhupada says, the king of the country, or the emperor of the empire, or let us say the leader of the country, in whichever country, must be so trained that by nature he renounces sense gratification. And he also mentions what happens if this is not done. Then there is degradation. Of course, the monarchy is lost today. We don't have it. And those countries which have monarchy, it is only in name. We will understand a little later as to how, by creating democracy, how this is failing the country, people also. And then eventually, this leads to dictatorship or misrule. So in other words, the common link between this all these points is the matter of God consciousness. The consciousness of the individuals who are leaders is the highest. And they recognize that it's a great burden, great responsibility for these personalities to live up to the expectations of the individuals of the country. So which means that they were not governed by popularity votes. They were not pushed by seeking re-elections or trying to get into the good books of the people. They actually led the people, which means that they set the standards. It is also presumed that clearly they would have to take some austere measures or difficult steps. And because they had credibility, people followed them. People had no hesitation because they actually set the example. For instance, we know in Lord Ram's case how he was loved by everybody. And why? Because, you know, he was so sensitive to the understanding of what people felt. If there was any sort of trace of unhappiness, he was constantly, he would want to know that. So in fact, he had spies. We also have spies today, but there's a difference. He had spies who would actually go around the country to gauge the satisfaction level of people, whether there is something which should be done further. And he was already more than satisfying all the people. I mean, people were in great happiness and bliss. And because they could see that he was leading a very saintly life himself, and total transparency in what he spoke and what he did. At the same time, he was concerned about the welfare of the people, the genuine welfare. Similarly, we see King Pratap Rudra, more recent times, when he was so humble, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu seemingly rejected him initially, he accepted it as that he was not worthy of it. So, and the reason which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu cited, he took it so seriously, he immediately said that I am willing to abandon my kingdom if that means that I can achieve Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then when he was sweeping the floors with the broom before the Rath Yatra started, he was also giving a very direct message that I am the king, I am your king, and yet I am the servant of the servants, and especially we are here to serve the Lord. So by deed, by action, by thought, you know, the kings were extremely conscious of the fact that the central point was always how to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And also, we see in every single king's case, those who were very pious and saintly kings, that invariably the way they took advice and treated the renounced order For instance, King the Vasishtha Maharaj, Vishwamitra Muni, in the times of Lord Ram, right through when they were not only symbolically worshipped as good as their as a guru, but also in reality, that they would consult them constantly to take advice what to do, and they subjugated their own feelings. Like in Dashrath Maharaj's case, you know, he was so attached to his son, and then when Vishwamitra Muni asked for his the two sons to join him, then they were only 15 or 16 years old, to kill the demons, that was a test for him. And of course, with all good intention, Dashrath Maharaj offered himself, his whole army. He said, "We will serve the purpose, but just leave these two young kids, they're just children." Because in his eyes, because of his attachment, he saw them as small children. You know, that his love overcame the real, you know, understanding of the position of Lord Ram. And then Vasishtha Muni, when he advised him, when he saw that Vishwamitra Muni was adamant, Vasishtha Muni told him that, "Let go, don't worry. They can defeat everybody." So as soon as Vasishtha Muni said this, immediately accepted. So even the toughest tasks, when they needed to, they were always willing to consult the right sources, and that was a day-to-day affair. In the courts also, when they met to discuss, take a decision on policy matters or which had far-reaching consequences, then right next to the king was always the Council of Ministers, and also the great saints who were given the pride of place. So at every level, they set the example. And why not? Because Lord Brahma, is the person whom we should, Prabhupada said that, you know, who better than to speak than the Lord Brahma, because he is really the leader of all universal affairs. He is the first creator, he should know. And when Swayambhuva Manu and his wife came to take instructions on how to serve Lord Brahma, when they came to Lord Brahma himself, and Lord Brahma's instructions were that if you do not serve Krishna, then your entire life is of no value. It's a complete waste. So from every quarter, every shastra, this is what comes out. And this is the reason why there was peace, prosperity, happiness among all the people. They were contented, there were no ambitions, there was no duplicity. If there were any signs of that, then that was the duty of the king to set the tone. Even if there were differences of opinion between within the family, it was all transparent. There was never any deviousness. And when we did see this kind of deviousness, like in the case of the Kauravas, and the duplicitousness when they were trying to, they did everything they could to not only kill the Pandavas, but also to snatch the kingdom unfairly. Then when it came just to establish the rule of law under the guidance of Lord Krishna, Yudhishthira Maharaj, much against his inclination, Yudhishthira Maharaj was completely made of a different nature. He was the most respected person in the universe at his time, but because of his fairness, his gentleness, his humility, his softness, he loved the people. But when it came to it, just to follow the dictates of Lord Krishna, he took it upon himself, and knowing that his brothers were there fully to support him, in fact, he had to control his brothers. But nevertheless, they did it when the time came. So the tests may be different, but when the challenges come for us in our individual capacity or in any established or any capacity where we have a leadership position, or let us even in a family, the head of the family, you are already in a leadership position. Both the father and the mother. For instance, it's not just that Pratap Rudra Maharaj was a leader. He was a leader. He was a servant leader. Kolavecha Sridhar was also a leader. Kolavecha Sridhar had nobody under him. He didn't even own anything. He was so poor. But because he established the highest examples, he set the highest example, he was also a great leader, actually, for many people to follow. So similarly, we have whatever position, it is not the number of people who work under us or we control that many. But we will be the leaders of society if we take to Krishna consciousness. And that is why Prabhupada said that the intelligent class are the ones who will come to Krishna consciousness. Not that those who are academically intelligent or materially intelligent are the leaders. In fact, it as we've seen in Queen Kunti's prayers, that actually of the four obstacles that come towards for spiritual progress, that high parentage, lot of wealth, similarly lot of intelligence is actually becomes an obstacle because we become puffed up. So, and also if we see logically that our own natures are such that we would like to we would like to satisfy our senses, this in the material world. Today, what is, because of the environment around us, the keenness is that let us enjoy wherever we can. If we mindlessly go follow the dictates of the senses, then we will be led astray. But actually, the real power lies in the subtle elements. Whether you see, even in the material world, as well as we will see it in the nature of things, that from the Mahatattva actually came at the time of creation, first came the false ego, and from that came the intelligence, then came the mind, then came the ether, air, water, and fire, and then earth. No, fire, water, and earth. So even from there we can see that the subtler elements are the ones which actually control the grosser elements. Also we see even in today's outside world, anywhere we see that the real power is not with the people who have, say, big bodies. The real power lies with people who are intelligent, who have been blessed with a sharp intelligence. But if the intelligence is misused, then our consciousness can completely deviate us, take us on a wrong path. So that is why we see that when we refer in the purport to Prabhupada's statement about democracy failing, it's because the meaning of democracy is supposed to be, as we were taught in our schools and colleges, that democracy means by the people, of the people, and for the people. But as our great Raj Bihari Prabhu explains, our Brahmachari, is by the people is B-O-I, by the people. And off the people means O-double-F, means you switched off the people. And for the people is changed into far from the people. So that is the definition of democracy today. So it has become a means to govern the country, whatever country, it is just not in India. The levels of sophistication may vary, but this is human nature. That basically everything works towards how you divide and rule. That there are different interest levels. So there are we cater to special interests. And those special interests develop loyalty towards that candidate or individual. And then cumulatively, we get a large vote bank. So in India, it may be based on caste or creed or religious basis. When the West, it may be based on, they have very clear demarcations. They also, there are Hispanics and then there are Jews and then there would be the gays and then you have the single parents. So depending on what you cater to, so you will change. So unlike the leaders of the past, where the leadership set the tone and the guiding principle was the consciousness of how to please Krishna, that would not change. Here, the guiding principle would be the consciousness should be how to be elected. How do we manage the next year or two? What do we need to do to please the people? So there is no basis of values. Everything is a short-term thing. This is whatever is needed to promise, so we can say what we want to, just to get ourselves in power and remain so. Can you imagine in the past, when the leaders today, when they're fighting for their own, even after they have been ejected, they lost the elections, and they don't want to give up their bungalows. And so many times we see after 1 year, 2 years also, sometimes a news item will come, which they may try to hide, but it comes out that so many, the list of people who are still, holding on to their bungalows. And when we know of Maharaj Vidur the Great, who was humiliated and kicked out of the kingdom, he didn't. He had no hesitation. He just walked out. He was no problem. Didn't think that first. Let me secure my own property and land and whatever. He just left. So that was the consciousness that this could stand for principles. And today, of course, we have by official statistics about 145 criminals in the Indian Lok Sabha. Of course, these are by the official definition. Doesn't mean that the others are not. The only thing that it's a matter of sophistication, and some are smarter than others, but the intent would be fairly similar. So basically, it becomes a question of manipulation and money power. So Srila Prabhupada quotes from the Bhagavatam saying that basically it depends on the consciousness and our intelligence. And bad intelligence can lead the to disastrous consequences. And Bhagavatam compares the bad intelligence, or which is contaminated intelligence, to an unchaste wife or unchaste husband. This unchaste wife will have several paramours, several lovers, especially the mind and the five senses, who are always. But then, when they see that there is competition, eventually these paramours will come to kill the husband, the unchaste or the unchaste wife. Similarly, if the intelligence which is impure, it is supposed to. What is the pure intelligence? The pure intelligence is one which really gives us the real knowledge. And what is real knowledge? Real knowledge is very simply that which actually guides the mind and the senses to serve the needs of the soul. And the needs of the soul are to serve the super soul. So that is real knowledge, and anything that is, if there's any contamination, then it will completely deviate from that path. And then instead of serving the real needs of the soul, it will actually serve the needs of the senses and the mind. Srila Prabhupada, when he went to MIT, which is the one of the highest institutions of learning, academic learning in the U.S., Massachusetts Institute of Technology, very, very prestigious. And he was so bold, he was never, ever compromised. He was very respectful, but very frank in how he assessed and spoke. And when he mentioned to them that you have so many departments, but why is it that there is no department for real intelligence? That is to explain what is the real need of, what is the real purpose of life, what is the symptoms of the soul, how can one develop our consciousness, the real consciousness? There is none. So he could tell them very, very frankly. And Prabhupada would call modern education slaughterhouses. I remember, I think perhaps for many devotees, at least for me, this was one of the most shocking statements, initially, because we go through academic institutions ourselves, and then this was a statement, and I didn't really, I could accept it and I could relate to it because it makes sense, but it was once in a class when His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj explained as to why Prabhupada called it slaughterhouses. Then it really stuck. So he said that, like, what happens in slaughterhouses? He says, in slaughterhouses, actually, it is not that those people are just killing the animals, but actually they are they have concern for the animals because they will feed the animals very well. They actually give them a lot of, not only a lot of food, the tastiest food. They will also have the ingredients so in such a way that they eat so that they become fatter and fatter, so that ultimately when they are, you know, the meat is good. So the action, if you see, maybe that, oh, they are giving them the best of food. But what is the consciousness? That they are plunderers, they are killers. They want to ultimately kill the animal. So similarly, what Prabhupada referred to as modern education is that modern education is also feeding us a lot of data, a lot of information, a lot of knowledge about the how to manipulate material energy. Basically, the information that we get is the manipulation of how the subtle elements can control the gross elements. Even in so-called spiritual approaches, like when you see miracles, for instance, or so-called miracles, I mean, these miracles are also nothing but, you know, mantras which are actually able to control the gross senses, the elements, and manipulate the subtler elements. So it is not necessarily spiritual. Similarly, so therefore the slaughterhouses, the reference to the slaughterhouse is that actually without the right base of spiritual foundation, without that consciousness, if one just develops more and more, then with this information, with the data, with all the knowledge and with the degrees that we can do more and more, we just get puffed up, we get so much caught up in our own abilities, that in our impact, the what we can create as an impact, that gives us so much satisfaction. So, and then you can see that to the extent that we are blessed with more intelligence, to that extent, we, instead of trying to understand where this intelligence came from, instead of trying to understand that everyone brings their own karma, but we get so caught up in our own impact. And this is how the whole world works. And ultimately, it is the control of the real intelligent people vis-a-vis the less intelligent, and then that is how the manipulation takes place. Yeah, and part of the process of enjoying the mind and senses with such consciousness would be that how we can manipulate others, how we can manipulate others' consciousness, and how we can use them as a resource in very, very subtle ways. It could be on individual basis, it could be country to country. Those who are leaders of a country which is powerful, how they could look at and see how we can manipulate in such a way. So ultimately it comes to exploitation. And basically that's how that happens when we have the center of attraction as ourselves, as opposed to having the Lord in the center. So you can see from the impact that has happened over the last, say, 40, 50 years at least, because that is something which we've either studied in recent history or ourselves experienced it, that this kind of sharp intelligence which some people are able to, they become richer, they become bigger, and they have an impact on the others. For instance, in the 60s and perhaps even in the 70s, you know, up to that time, there was so many small shops, so small businesses. This is in the West. In India, it's happening now, but we are about maybe 25 years behind. But at that time, there were so many small shops and businesses. People were successful, happy, contented, relatively. And typically in small towns, people knew each other. And then with the advent of these large malls, gigantic supermarkets and department stores, suddenly, all of these disappear. They're finished. So then you have one large corporation, 150,000 people, 200,000 people, owned by someone who's 3,000 miles away. And then for the rest, they either have to serve or they have to starve. So from following their own Vaishya qualities of doing some little business or trade on their own, they start sweeping the floors for someone else. They have no alternative. And this is actually, it's been a revolution over the last 30, 40 years. And for instance, the largest retail company in the world, Walmart, has 2 million employees and has a turnover of $500 billion. So it is bigger than India's economy. So you can imagine the clout with that, which we cannot see, but we can imagine. That's such a, so anything that is detrimental to an organization like that would be concerning also their government. So that is the clout that they can use. And it is not the only one. There are several like this. So this is how the influence circles work. And with the money power and with the influences that are there, it can alter policies. So actually, the leadership is usually catering to seeing how they can elect themselves. And for that, they have to in turn look at who can support them and help them to financially be elected, which means ultimately it is the money power. I have personal experience in how this works when at some point in time, some years ago, one of the top leaders of the country, who's he is a union minister today, and he was attempting to become the prime minister when there was an opportunity. And then he was using a couple of his close friends in business. And then that's how they were kind of canvassing and seeing. So he had approached me, and he explained to me in detail that, you know, each constituency, this is 10 years ago, that each constituency, there are 542 constituencies. He says each MP needs about 5 crores. MLA is about 50 lakhs. So basically to buy out the MPs. And this is a known, among circles, this is a known fact. There is nothing, and they also do not see there is anything kind of negative, because they feel that they would call it the party money, but ultimately there's a thin line differentiating between individuals and parties. So this is how the degradation and corruption takes place. And it's not just the corruption of the money, which is there, but which comes through the consciousness, but the corruption of the mind and the soul, and the corruption of values, which is much more sinister and much more deep-rooted. So part of the corruption of the values and the soul is such that it suits the West to misguide in poorer countries and just keep on harping on the corruption of the money, which is a relatively smaller issue in the larger context of society and of people's development. That, and when they are over time, when they are changing their own values and made forced to move into values of which are totally materialistic, it is done in a very sinister way, and in such a way that ultimately one says that there is no choice. That say a country like India or the poorer countries have no way to go to have no way but to follow the powers that be. And because that pressure has come on them, then gradually, so that is not seen. That is so subtle that we do not consider it as corruption. But that's how it works. Prabhupada had a word for it. He called it honor among thieves. That ultimately they're stealing Krishna's property, no matter which country, which person. But and then they divide it up among themselves, saying that this is from. So they have a certain honor among themselves. But finally, at the end of the day, you can define them as thieves because they're taking Krishna's property. And things are getting much worse also. That is why Srila Prabhupada had the courage in 1975, as you must have read in his Leelamrit, that in 75 August, which was actually the beginning of a very very unusual period in Indian in history. That was the time of the emergency. Many of you may not even be aware of it, but it was the time when we had dictatorship for almost 2 years. And but the point is that Prabhupada had the courage to, at the start of the dictatorship, which was called the emergency. It was the emergency was declared, and under that, all the opposition leaders and all of put into jail. And yet he had the courage to seek an appointment with the Prime Minister at that time. And he went to the Prime Minister, and he had gone with a couple of his disciples, but then at the gate he was not allowed to take them in. He was asked to come inside alone. And he had such conviction and confidence in Krishna that he didn't see, that you know, this is such a powerful person who's being able to put everyone in jail and so on. It can intimidate anyone. You know, if you were to go by that, if you read the newspapers all the time and see that, Morarji Desai, Vajpayee, X-ray, all these people are in jail, and in here you're going to meet. So it could have some kind of effect on us. Prabhupada said none. He was looking from the laws of Krishna, the laws of Manu, you can say. And he had a small slit of paper just as a reminder, which actually served to give us the details later on in the Satswarup Maharaj's book, the Lilamrit. And what was Prabhupada's message? Prabhupada went to the Prime Minister, who was perhaps the most powerful person, one of the most powerful person on the planet at that time. And he went with a clear mission. And what he had in his mind was, there were 10 points which he wanted to tell Prabhupada. Prabhupada wanted to tell the Prime Minister that this is what our country should do. The first was, all MPs should be initiated Brahmins. Second, close slaughterhouses. Third, there should be chanting. Fourth, meat eating, if at all people cannot avoid. Because he was practical, he knew that there were tens of millions of people who were already eating meat. So if at all they can't avoid, they should eat at home, no public places. Prostitution should be punishable. No religious group except Bhagavad Gita as it is. Note, he was not promoting ISKCON, he was not saying ISKCON. He was talking of Vaishnavism and Bhagavad Gita as it is. So he called it a religious group, meaning those, in other words, those who follow Bhagavad Gita, those who follow Krishna, those who follow what he says. This is very nice. All government officers should join Kirtan twice a day at least. He had the courage to actually present it to the Prime Minister. Then support Krishna consciousness all over the world. And then, of course, Sanjay the King, that was a practical, probably concession, strategic concession to win the other 9 points. And visas for foreign devotees. Because that time, you know, there was all rumors that there's, you know, spies, the CIA agents and so on and so forth. But what we learn from this is the complete, utter fearlessness and conviction that he had. Such was that it didn't matter whom he was looking at. He just went in calmly, alone, presented his point of view, and perhaps to our surprise, but not to him, that the Prime Minister heard patiently. Of course, he said later that she seemed very distracted because of all the problems that are happening. But so obviously it was going probably all around the head. But the fact is that that is unfortunate for the Prime Minister as well as for the country that nothing really progressed. But he did what he had to do because he saw himself as an instrument of Krishna, and he could do it. So this is what our leader, let's say if you are following the movement of Vaishnavism as part of ISKCON, this is what we can encourage, that the one is to include the whole world. At the same time, the principles go beyond skin deep. We don't go by the skin, but at the same time, the principles are something which are not superficial. They are there for a long time. Similarly, Prabhupada also wrote to Mahatma Gandhi in 1946 July, which is quite amazing. There was 47 July, 6 months before Gandhiji was shot dead. And he wrote to him saying that, he spoke very nicely about him. You have done a great service for the country to deliver it. But now you should actually spend more time. He said, your life is in danger. Imagine, 6 months before, he says, your life in danger, you could be killed. And you should actually now spend more time directly preaching and propagating Bhagavad Gita, Krishna consciousness. This is your duty. You should quit in the governance and now concentrate on that. Because how much power you have, how much you could influence so many people. He never got a reply, but as we saw, in 6 months' time, unfortunately, Gandhiji died. But again, the same thing, that Srila Prabhupada had no hesitation in doing what was absolutely necessary. So basically, today, the lack of consciousness means that The way society has been set up and the governance of the countries is, the way the governments work, that there is a clear nexus, you can say, between big business, between banks, between the governments, the politicians. And this is how it works. And it is well documented and by people who are in the inside of that. And not only that, but even they can control the media, because ultimately the media all over the world are really in the hands of just a handful of very strong and powerful people who own hundreds of newspapers and TV shows and not shows but TV stations and cable networks and so on. So across the globe. So ultimately they have so much power that if they support one person as a prime minister or president, it could have a huge impact. So I wanted to just read out something which actually is a direct proof of what I'm saying. When we talk of how the media, that is the press, is actually manipulated by the people who control it. Here, this is a speech which was given by a gentleman called John Swinton, and he was the former chief of staff at the New York Times. The New York Times is perhaps the most prestigious newspaper of the United States and one of the more famous ones in the world. And he was giving, he was retiring, so he was giving a toast. He was asked to give a toast, that means speak at the prestigious New York Press Club in 1953. And this John Swinton, the former chief of staff at the New York Times, he made this candid confession. And it's worth noting that Swinton was called the dean of his profession. So he was so respected by other newsmen because he was admired greatly. So please pay attention, because this is something quite remarkable what he said. And as is mentioned, it was a very honest confession. He said, "There is no such thing at this date of the world's history as an independent press. You know it and I know it. There is not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions. And if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper I am connected with. Others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. If I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone." Now, this is what he says. "The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, and to fawn." Vilify means to heavily criticize, and to fawn means flatter and praise. "To vilify and to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell the country for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it, and what folly is this, toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of the rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes." Now, this is a very heavy statement, but coming from a very honest person who actually admits what is exactly what we perhaps sense or we perceive, we feel, and he just crystallizes in 10 lines saying what the state of affairs is. And that is actually the truth, that no matter... So anyone who wants... So what we read, as devotees also, what we read, what we hear, we have to use our intelligence to know what we have to take. Otherwise, you just read, go by the newspaper and you get shaken up. You talk. It is, you are reading what you are supposed to be reading. You are reading what others want you to read in most cases. So even the slant that is given. So we have to take with a heavy pinch of salt. I mean, you should not be shaken by events. You know, eventually the facts will come out. We not get perturbed by it. And then there are always games people will play. So there is also another thing that... you may not have heard, you certainly wouldn't have heard of this term called the economic hitmen. Now, I had not heard about it till recently, till I read about that. Actually, economic hitman, just like hitman is someone who is like a sharpshooter, what they call, you know, in the someone who an assassin or someone who's eliminating someone. So that's what they call. They're loosely referred to as jackals. Means they're always very shady, very not seen. But when the need comes, they're used. But before these people come the economic hitmen. These economic hitmen are very highly paid professionals who get outrageous salaries for cheating countries of trillions of dollars. And who employ them? Means what they do is they funnel monies from, say, World Bank, from IMF and large institutions. Ultimately, they go into the coffers of the private individuals and the rich people and those countries where these people belong. And it is done in a so-called legal way. It is there's total legality. The thing is that what happens, and this is a book actually written by an economic hitman. He says he himself was that. Four times he was bribed or threatened, so he didn't write. And finally he wrote it before he, because it was tormenting him. And the way it is that in the last 60, 70 years, as the countries have, after the Second World War, so the prosperity of particularly United States, which is the main leader in this, when they are actually convincing other countries, and there are hundreds of countries, out of 210, perhaps 150, 160 countries which are considered to be not fully developed or very poor. The whole African belt, most of the Asia, a large part of Africa, South America. And these countries, when they are given so-called aid, so the money is taken from... So these people, their task is... it's all economic, but their task is to persuade these countries, the poorer countries, to take loans. They convince them, bribe them, and somehow they get the job done. There is a whole detail of how they do it. But get them to take huge loans, you know, country-to-country loans, 20 billion, 10 billion, 5 billion, money which they cannot afford and which they borrow over the next, say, 20, 30 years. They're given soft loans. And then the condition is that you use this to buy from the U.S., you know, power plants or big electric dams, hydroelectric dams, and so on. Now, for poor countries, these are the various things which one huge project or two, three huge projects actually can derail a country. And then these people cannot pay. The country defaults after 5 or 10 years, with the result that eventually they will... Once they are in a trap, once they are... they are not able to pay, then they've got them where they want because they have to get some help to be able to pay or to get more relief. And then that's where the exploitation starts. Now, for instance, if any military base has to be put in that country or any puppet regime has to be put or any major assets of that country are there, this is how, for instance, Saudi Arabia is controlled by the U.S. There's no commonality between the two. If you see Saudi Arabia, which is completely a desert kingdom, having so much of, in one sense, unmaterialistic approach, except for the 5,000 princes who govern it. But then because they have been trapped into this for the last 30 years, and they've allowed themselves to be trapped, so then all this huge hundreds of billions of dollars of oil money, because oil is so important for them, it is actually the money which is spent and they used to basically buy, you know, whether it's planes or guns or tanks, that is the armament, for their safety, or whether it is for economic development, infrastructure, you know, huge ports and roads and electric plants, nuclear plants, so many, all these massive investments. Ultimately, in fact, it's a win-win thing because they get, they say, we'll develop it for you, and at the same time, all that money goes back to those countries. But then they're induced to do it. So the many countries, and this book documents it in detail. This person who wrote it, he was so close to two leaders in Southern America, in Panama and Ecuador. And in fact, these are these names, when you mentioned them, we knew them because they were household names. They were very famous because they were supposed to be leaders of their country. Both were killed by the CIA. And he himself knows how it happened and what was mentioned. So basically, initially the economic hitmen go to persuade the arm twist and they get the countries to start working on that. If they fail, then the jackals take over. That is the hitmen who, the individuals who try to assassinate and do it. And if they fail, then the military takes over. So he gives in details how, for instance, in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, you know, whatever dictatorship and actions that he did, the U.S. and the West was not concerned with the morality of it. They may project it that way. This is how it has been seen. But because the Saddam Hussein was given every opportunity and temptation to fall in line like with Saudi Arabia, but he didn't agree for his own reasons. So otherwise, if he had followed, then it would have been perfect for him. He would have had his own life. He could do what he wanted. So there is ruthlessness all around. There is only self-serving interest. There is no, the horror of the morality which is projected later on. There is justification. That is another thing. So because he chose not to, and then that's how. And the economic hitman could not persuade the, and he was well protected. Then the army took over. The military took over, and then the whole war was staged. So it is in so many countries, and it's just an amazing thing that a person had the courage to write it, because he came to a stage where he says, he's basically for his daughter. His daughter persuaded him. He says, even if you are killed also, I will take this on. But let we can't let our children, grandchildren, and others not be in the dark. Similarly, all the destruction of the environment, how the big oil companies operate, when they exploit these backward countries in South America and Africa, and some parts of the Asia, where so it is done in such a systematic way and with such power, because in most cases they have more power than the local governments, because they have such a huge clout in those countries. So it is very sinister, but it is also an eye opener for us to know that actually wherever we look outside for success or for inspiration, we are not going to see it in the material world. We will find it by the genuine people who are living and striving to be the instruments in the Lord's hands and who live by that life. So it may be in different countries, wherever they are, but these are the people. So life will be very short, but when it ends, will be very difficult to justify what we were doing. So he makes a very important point. He says that sometimes people feel that, oh, there is a kind of cozy club, it is not like that. It is not that. It's just that there are people who are now having a common concept, common values, and that value, they genuinely believe in it. That value is that economic growth drives happiness all over the world, which is a fallacy, which is not true. But that economic growth will drive. So therefore, the pursuit of economic growth is the most important thing, and eventually everybody will be solved. And the corollary of that is that those who those who increase the economic growth, that means those people who are helping in the improvement of this of the economic growth, their leaders or the political leaders, business leaders, economic leaders, social leaders in their country, who wherever they are to be rewarded and to be encouraged, and the rest are there for exploitation. This is the fundamental belief on which the economics of the world exists today. This is the fundamental belief of the people, of the system, of the people. And this holds all. That's why if you see in Western Europe, in the US, and many parts of Asia, wherever they're, especially those who are prosperous, this is the governing principle, that economic growth is above all. Nothing else counts. Anything can be justified. So exploitation of land, complete rape of the environment, destruction of the soil, the way we live, and how we can get the resources for us right now. We don't care what happens in 10, 20 years. This is the driving force. And secondly, those who propagate it, those who are stoking the fuel of this economic growth, are to be rewarded. So that's the way the system is. So those who are doing well, they'll be rewarded and encouraged. And those who are not, then they are there meant to be exploited. They are on the fringe, so they are to be exploited. So therefore, we need to do the minimum that is necessary just to make our maintenance. But really, we need to seek our own future and direction, our guidance, our guiding principles in life from the scriptures. That is why Krishna has written the scriptures primarily so that he gives us real knowledge, not how to manipulate material energy, but how to understand how infinitesimal we are, that we come from him, we belong to him, and we actually have to go back to him. Just an example of how the system works. The largest infrastructure company in the world. Infrastructure means the one company who put up power plants, roads, etc., etc. It's a private company called Bechtel, and Mr. Bechtel himself is the chairman of the company. In the 80s, he had two deputies. One deputy became the finance minister of the country, and the other deputy became the foreign minister of the country simultaneously. And after they finished the stint, they went back to him. So they report to him, to an individual, and then they became the foreign minister, the treasury secretary, that is the finance minister. So this is just an example of how, and then the networking that they know, because they have established so much contacts. So when they're hired back with 8-figure salaries, it's primarily so that they can open doors. And another proof, if any is needed, that some may question, how can this, where is the room for ideology is not there. I mean, I have been a student for economics for the last 30 years, and I have, if any of you have been studying, we have been brought up thinking that the West represents liberal economics, the West represents private initiative, individual capitalism, individual growth. Government should not intervene. This is the main thrust. And those who have been preaching that, the Western countries, have been hitting hard constantly at the socialism or the communism or the countries where governments play a major role in influencing the where nationalizing industries took place. That means government takes over the ownerships and so on. So this has been a major theme. Not only that, even the institutions which work under them, the IMF, World Bank, are also primarily pushing for opening up and forcing the government, those countries which take loans, to then gradually let private enterprise and private initiative, private ownership take over. But private ownership automatically means there's more corruption. But anyway, this is a different view. But then, in September of 2008, when the financial crisis really hit the world, worst crisis in 80 years, as they say, in one weekend, they just went from being the most liberal or the most private initiative country in the world to the largest ownership. They came up with a $800 billion economic package. They took over all the banks, major insurance institutions. So it is, it is all hypocritical. It is what serves the purpose at that time. It is what we see. So this is all, we don't need to get too much caught up in this, but we also don't need to fool ourselves in thinking in wishful thinking. This is for it should strengthen our understanding of what the scriptures say, of what the governance of monarchy, the true monarchy that was there, or the true leaders that were there, that those who were given the maximum power, they lived as if they had no power, as if they had no, they didn't deserve any mercy. The best example of this is Vidur. We discussed about him. I mean, he was the son of a maidservant, but he was also the brother of Dhritarashtra, and he was his right-hand man. He was his best advisor. He was, now look at the qualities of leadership. He was so frank. He was so honest. Blunt. You know, he so many times he told his brother, in a nice way but very firm way, that you get rid of your son, he will destroy the whole dynasty. And the thing is, his brother, that is Dhritarashtra, knew that Vidur was right. He knew that Vidur had no malice. Imagine somebody telling that your son is a this and that, and you have so much love for your son. It's very difficult to establish trust in the person who's telling you. So this is the caliber of Vidur, that who could actually keep that level of trust in his, because he had absolutely no personal agenda. You're seeing from the eyes of the Shastra. Also, see his humility, that he was so badly humiliated himself and kicked out. So though he was fearless and he spoke his mind and he was told to move, and for a person who has reached that level where he practically the Kauravas were controlling the entire world when the Pandavas were in the forest. The whole world, imagine. And you are in the court of that world and you are the chief advisor to the king. And then your own nephew, who is a prince, insults you in such sharp language in front of everyone and tells you to get out, kicks you out right away. You know, it can be really hurting. But he just walked out. So such was his humility that he did not even go to his closest friend, that is Krishna. We know that Krishna actually loved him so much that just a few weeks before that, he was coming regularly as a peace messenger to the Kauravas, and he used to stay in Vidur's house. He made it publicly known. He said, I am not going to accept, he told Duryodhana on his face that I will never stay, I don't want to stay at Dushasana's house where you had made, I would like to stay at Vidur's house. So everybody knew that Vidur was so closely loved and held in esteem by Krishna. Yet when he was asked to leave, he didn't go to Dwarka. He could easily have gone to Dwarka because Dwarka was, he could have, he knew where the power lay, really. But he just quietly went for a yatra. And his first thoughts was, he was deeply grateful to Duryodhan. This is the greatness of Vidur, that he was grateful. Why? Because he said that this is, though he did feel hurt, but in his devotional intelligence was so sharp and so high that he saw this as Krishna's arrangement. Krishna's arranged it in such a way for him to make further inroad, more contact into his own devotional service and to cultivate his loving relationship with the Lord. So he just took this as a blessing. He took as a blessing. This is the way how a pure devotee thinks. He looks at everything from that Krishna has arranged it. What is the reason? And he sees that, well, now I'm free of any responsibility. I've done what I could. I'm not attached. He just left it and he went all over. And then when he comes back at the peak, at the end, when everything is over. All that he said was vindicated. Everything that he was saying, it was truthful, and the war was over. Everybody was finished. Now, one would expect that he comes back to stake his claim on my property. You know, I've been out and I should come. Nothing. He just came to take his brother away. And he came and he gave some harsh but very honest advice in such that finally it hit home, that Dhritarashtra finally could hear him and accept that advice. And Jais told him that, you know, why are you living like a dog? And you just leave and come now. You know, this is... But the consciousness of Vidur as a leader was always that he was completely detached. He was doing his duty in the best capacity, such that even the Lord was so pleased with him and he stayed at his house often. But at the same time, when it came to that, in the discharge of his duty, he was sacked and he was humiliated, he was pushed out, condemned in public. He accepted it, went away quietly on his own, did not make any fuss, did not go to Dwarka, and then comes back in such a mentality that just to help, he didn't even feel any kind of bitterness towards his brother, saying that, see, I told you, you caused the destruction, and now you are, no, he didn't, because he was already in the highest spiritual platform, and he wanted his brother to, he was so compassionate that he wanted his brother to follow him, and he took him with him to the forest. So this is the standards that we have, not too far ago, of the great leaders of our country. And that is where we see the scriptures come alive. That is not just a story, but actually in our own small ways, we have a leadership role to play for our children, for the immediate family. So in that, are we governed by the highest principles, or are we governed by our immediate self-interest? This is the question, and this is very beautifully answered by Srila Prabhupada. So we end here. If there's any questions or comments? Yes, Lord.
Hare Krishna. Prabhu, I always used to have this doubt in my mind that if a person who, as you said, that if you get glamoured with outside world and you get carried away and you go aggressively, as you said, that economic growth is the only thing in our life. When a person in the beginning days, he also, because the culture is that way, and he aggressively goes that way, that economic growth is everything in his life, and he goes in a very aggressive mood. And once he goes in an aggressive mood, definitely he will be getting carried away with all these politicians, criminals, all sorts of things. And he had to go on satisfying them and doing all unethical things also. And after some point of time, he might be reaching to highest peak in his material life by doing all unlawful things. And external world, he might be shown that he is a very successful man, very successfully has done everything all right. But then he just have to see to it that all those people, all those criminals, politicians, all those people has to keep them happy. So he has to go on bribing them regularly, and he has to go on doing manipulation in his books of accounts also, just to see that everybody is satisfied. Banks, institution, stocks, share prices, everything has to be satisfied just to see that everybody becomes happy. And this type of a manipulation goes on for year after year after year. So sometimes a person gets an inside glimpse in his heart that what am I doing all these things? This is all nonsense going on. And if he gets little bit inclination in spiritual life after some point of time, he cannot accept spiritual life wholeheartedly, because that requires lots of commitment and guts in his heart, because everything has to be stopped after that. And once everything has to be stopped, his company's performance will go down, stocks will be go down, all banks and institutions, everybody, those who have given them loan, they will be taking back the money, everything in a tipsy-towsy way. So that he cannot do that, and because of that reason, he will go on pulling, doing all those manipulation for the whole lifetime. So what about those people, those who are getting carried away and wants to get out from it, and still all these things makes them really afraid and fearful, and due to that reason they cannot get out. What is the lesson for them? What those people, because many people having that inside thing that I'm doing that is everything is nonsense, and every year I'm just showing good performance, but inside the performance is not there. And this is going on. And 1 year also the performance is bad, they are again in the square one, and everything becomes tipsy-towsy. So what is the solution for those people?
What you say is actually very true. Before I answer the question directly, I remember reading, one of our ex-presidents of the country was Gyani Zail Singh. Many of you may have, Sadaji in the 80s, and he was a close confidant of Mrs. Gandhi, and then he was made the president. And I remember one statement he made, very stark and typical of him, but he was a very frank person at times, probably sometimes too frank. And he said that he was already in his late 70s or maybe early 80s. He said, it's not that many people are telling that politicians, in their 80s and they just want to carry on, they can't leave. But they don't know the reason. He said that we would like to also, if I want to leave also, but we have the way we have governed and the way we have used the levers of control and power, that it is impossible for us to leave. We have to continue to be in power to be able to cover up what we have done. It was such a stark statement that it struck me that coming from a president of India, that's why they have to be in politics, because unless you are contemporary, unless you are, if you are completely like mothballed, as you say, you know, and completely retired, and you may think, he's got made so much money, he can go and enjoy himself. And then somebody digs up the past, and so you have to be there to see that the CBI or with this or that. This is what he said. So it is. So we may externally see that, he's made it and his next 20 generations made it, but we don't know what his state of mind is, you know, because he's all the time worried. And we have seen that it happens. Now, answering your question, yes, ultimately, see, if his desire is strong, if he's supposing he's caught himself, got himself into a trap, and he finds that he's being, now he just can't get out. But it's one thing to be having a weak, at some moment, frustration, he may have that weak feeling that, I wish it was different. But then when things change, and then when he sees the taste of power, and then he wants to, he enjoys that other part also. So he's being pulled both ways, because he actually enjoyed. So if his desire is weak, then Krishna is not going to reward him. But if his desire is strong, and that frustration boils over, and he's extremely agitated internally, and he's really fine, then Krishna will help him. So perhaps he might have a very devastating external effect. Perhaps he might have a major humiliation. Perhaps he might have a crash in terms of, you know, the way people see him, or he's thrown out. Some major adversity may come in, and then whether he sees it as an opportunity or not, ultimately it's in his hands. So actually, up to a point we can be sympathetic, but essentially everybody has a free choice. So some people are blissfully ignorant, and they're so steeped into this lifestyle that they wouldn't even have the slightest bit of worry, even though they have frustration and anxiety constantly, but they think that the solution is more control and how I could do it. For instance, now, if the finance minister is a problem, let me see if I can tackle the prime minister. That kind of mentality will be there. So I have to do something or the other all the time. But if then there's nothing, you know, he will dig his own grave and pay for it. But those who sometimes they get a glimpse of wisdom, let's say, or they've heard something, or they actually have their own sanskars come forth. The karma is giving them an opportunity to be in touch with the reality. They hear the truth and they find they're so remorseful and saying, we're so stuck, now what do we do? If the desire is there, Krishna will definitely help. But then help in such a way that it will not be an easy help. I mean, because it will be initially more pain, and whether he's willing to accept that will depend on his desire. So situation will be created, and then whether he is willing to take that, or whether he is willing to take the same old cronies or help to get out of the problem that he may be in. Because, you know, if you have been hit very badly financially, or if you hit, your reputation is in tatters, you may be jailed for some time, some major thing happens, and if you don't see it as Krishna's arrangement, and if you don't reform, then you can't blame anyone, then there's no sympathy that we can have. So actually, if somebody's been given those four principles of material life, you know, high parentage, wealth, etc., wisdom and looks, we can sympathize with him. That poor fellow, he's really burdened so much. But then, if he gets a calamity, it's an opportunity for him to see that he has now a window, and that he could can link himself up and try to bring it. Because that time, when you're so vulnerable, all this will just seep in, you know, everything you can grasp, because you are in desperate position. We have all experienced it, that when we come in distress, everything makes sense. And then when things are smooth, then becomes a distant mental, you know, dream that, yeah, okay. So actually, when the wound is raw, that time the balm is so soothing. So when he is really, really, and everybody will go through it. And so he should seem as fortunate. But if he doesn't, then what can we do? So they will have an opportunity, without doubt. They will have. If they have a desire, Krishna will create a situation where. But we may not see it. We may see that, you know, now he's gone to jail, or he's completely devastated. He's been thrown out of his party, or he's been exposed, whatever. But internally, when he's like Avanti Brahman, he's completely abandoned. But if he sees it that way, then, you know, how Avanti Brahman got the realization. No, nobody had to come and tell him. He just got that. Krishna only brought it in his own, from his heart. That he was in. And if, before that, one would never imagine that this person could have this wisdom. The life he led, perhaps the most unpopular person on the planet at that time. Everybody hated him. And yet, when he was so remorseful and so disgusted with himself, And then he accepted all the insults and humiliation. So then he got a chance to transform. So a person will, you know, this is subtle and this is an internal thing. Each one, when we meet also as devotees, we really cannot understand each individual situation, how that person, how your life, what you are going through, what you are thinking, how you are being pulled by both the sides, and how you are making progress, and how you make your choices. So nobody can do it. Each person has his own set of circumstances which Krishna has designed. These are tests, you can say. These are tests. So similarly, even for others, they are all going through tests, but then they choose to fail. If the question paper is given, the answer paper is given, and yet you just put a zero and give it the paper back. So then you can't be, you have no sympathy for them because Krishna has given him the opportunity. But there's no doubt that he will be, if he has a desire, he will be somehow given his own unique set of circumstances where he has a chance to re-examine his life. For sure. But that we can also see how the trap is so strong that it's really difficult to come out.
So Prabhuji, but that will require lots of commitment and determination. Because the position he has been on that level is so high. And if he wants to get out, it is a completely 100% opposite direction. So that requires lots of determination and commitment that he feels it, that this is the only path. And I don't want to counteract, even irrespective of whatever opposition I'll get it, I'll face it out. That is really requires lots of commitment. And that is very rare in Kali Yuga.
That's true. But then if a desire is there that he wants to get out of that mess, then Krishna will give that. I mean, if you go to see, there's so many disciples of Prabhupada. Most of disciples of Prabhupada, if you see there, before they came to Prabhupada, nobody would ever have thought that where is the determination to do what they did? Where is it going to come from? But they took shelter and see the complete transformation. So faith can move mountains. We actually have seen many, many mountains have moved just because faith has been put. It's incredible. Each one is a story. At 19 and 20, they would go to another continent and go and talk to the Beatles, do this, do that. I mean, this is only some of the stories we know, but this is the way it has went. Somebody goes to, the Africa. You know, imagine they would probably have never have left their own country or even the city, and now they've gone. So they took up so many challenges, and we saw. So actually, we see that this determination came from where did it come from? They had it in him. Krishna gave it to them because they just turned to Krishna. So the first step you have to do. So if they don't turn towards Krishna in some form or the other, then how can they expect that it just falls from the into their lap? It's not going to happen. And that falling in the lap or that is it may be externally a painful situation, but then he can recognize it if he is gets that opportunity. So therefore, we say that out of causeless mercy, if we have been given a chance to be to associate with devotees, we never had any strong desire to be Krishna conscious, when we it was seemingly accidental, but nevertheless we have got that opportunity. So then to abandon it is the most miserable person in the world, that who actually has been given the taste and he wants to give it up. So somebody who's not got it, if he has a desire, it'll come. Maybe this lifetime, maybe next lifetime. Yes, Mike.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, my question is, for a sadhaka, an aspirant who is full of mumukshatvam, is making money, or the lure for making money in a rightful way, is it taboo?
Making money?
In a rightful way, in a legitimate way, is it taboo for
no.
a sadhaka?
No, it is not. It depends on what situation we are in. If we are in a situation where most people would be living outside and earning, so nowhere does it say that we abandon our occupation. Nowhere does it say that we should not be earning. It's a question of what consciousness we have in which we serve the Lord. So if the circumstances turn out that a person becomes very, very successful, or if he's going to be at just a moderate level, how he leads his life, how he utilizes his money, how he takes care of his family, how he helps the spiritual environment to progress within in his own life and help life of others. It doesn't say that he has to give up money. He may choose to later in life if he's come to a very high level of spiritual understanding and his responsibility to discharge. That's another thing. But in almost all cases when they're going on a day-to-day basis, no, Krishna never says that. So he can, it's just a matter of internal consciousness. There is no external that he comes here. You see, almost all the people here, who are here, they are coming from different backgrounds and different occupations. So we just carry on where we are, but now we see ourselves in a different light. Right? There's one more question then.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, thank you very much for an eye-opening class. My question is just an extension to Anand Vrindavan Prabhu's question. It's a very practical question and many of devotees might have thought about it. Actually, most of the devotees who have a good salary, they must be investing in stock exchange, their savings. And now after hearing your lecture, we have a little guilty feeling that we are investing our money in a stock exchange and most of the companies are manipulating the economy. And so now if we don't invest our savings in that companies, then where should we invest our money?
No, first of all, it's not that all companies are doing it. There's some who may be doing it. Secondly, there are several opportunities to invest in various ways. And also, even in the stock exchange, I mean, it's not that when you, it's your consciousness that you need to see. So, if you know, obviously, that somebody is doing criminal activities, then definitely we don't entertain that. But otherwise, you know, when you, invest wisely, there's nothing wrong in investing wisely. The problem is not so much which company you choose. The problem is that in the stock market, that investment makes you greedy. That is the problem. Krishna will condone if he says, because you're not supposed to know that this the person who's heading this company is a crook and he's done this and that. I mean, you may not know, that's okay. If you know, that's another thing. But in most cases, you don't know. But what Krishna would definitely worry about for you, or what we should be worrying about more, is that slowly we have the speculative nature, we want to have short-term money, we want to gain. So we fool ourselves saying that it's a long-term investment and then change. That's why. And there also Krishna has given us a solution. We have a ideal investor advisor. I think no temple has such a perfect combination. He has asked so many questions that he's the only one who knows all the answers now. No, but I mean it in the best sense. I think most of us experience it, that he has, he has a very nice understanding. So it's a complex situation. So we have different issues that I've invested in this or that, in this instrument, whether it is speculative or not. I've also discussed with him often. And he has great clarity. So we can go to the right people and ask. But if you don't ask, then and we do it ourselves, then obviously we are not serious enough. So if there's a doubt and an anxiety, it's good, but we can clarify it. Right? Any more questions? Yeah. Jagannath Vallabhu.
Hare Krishna Babaji, this is not really spiritual, but you explained the whole thing that about the economy hitmen. And where does our country stand, India as such? in the vulnerability to this?
Well, we in the 60s, 70s and 80s, we were resisting it very strongly. And now we have the circumstances that are there. We are getting sucked into it. In the last 2 months alone, there are many things which you read just in a few days. Suddenly, there are inexplicable movements of how it's done. So, It's difficult to predict or say, but at least it looks as if we're not as badly off as some of the, what they call, puppet regimes, but we're coming, we're being pushed in a corner.
Thank you.
Shouldn't worry us, because ultimately, you know, the country is only defining a particular border. We do the best we can, but Prabhupada has given us the whole world as one country. You know, we go to Mayapur, it's technically in India, but you are in a different world, isn't it? You see all people all over the, from every single nationality and country, they are there. So, you know, that's one great fortune that we have. We are also given that vision to see in a perspective which goes beyond just our own, you know, border. So we have a certain anxiety at one level, but the higher anxiety or the higher vision would be to see it in a context where this doesn't matter. You know, we have to do our duty, and in our duty, these are all things which we need to know about, be concerned about, but not that it consumes our entire anxiety and it really doesn't have to. It'll go on. Nothing will change, and so many things will happen, you know, in future. We will get what Krishna wants us to get, and what we are not supposed to get, he will not give us. So what is in our quota, we will get. What is not in our quota, we will not get. And to the extent that we make effort, but then we see the signals from Krishna that he's blocked this, he's opened this, or his unexpected boon, or unexpected loss, it happens. And we just carry on the best we can. But within that, how we can serve our congregation, people who count for us, Guru Maharaj and Prabhupada, I mean, that should be our primary concern. Secondary can be, you know, whether we are caught up with the EHMs or not. Right? Yeah. Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.